Good afternoon, everyone. If you'd take a seat, we'll be ready to begin. Thank you. So first, we've got a small announcement.
Good afternoon. Please forgive the glasses and the stern look over the top because I can't see what I'm looking at if I don't have them. I'm Karen Brown. I'm the Director of Marketing and Communications for Campus Life, and I'm here as a volunteer event manager. And my duty today is to welcome you to this great event and remind you that on behalf of the university, all participants at the university, Cornell values responsible speech and expression and the maintenance of public order. Specifically, our campus code states freedom to express oneself and to be heard, and freedom to assemble and lawfully protest peacefully are essential to academic freedom. These rules apply to all persons on the campus or using its buildings. Quite simply, the speaker has a right to speak without intimidation, and the audience has a right to hear what the speaker has to say. The code further states, those who dislike what an invited speaker is saying also have rights. Those who oppose a speaker may make their views known so long as they do not thereby interfere with the speaker's ability to be heard or the right of others to listen. Thank you for giving me this opportunity and enjoy the program.
So welcome, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Frank DeSalvo. I'm the director of the Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. We are going to be joined online by a lot more people that are in the room here, I think. And Mark, would you put up that slide? If you are joining us online, at the end of the presentation, you'll have an opportunity to send in questions either by Twitter or by email. And these are the coordinates for doing the same. We'll put this up at the end of the talk as well so that it can be seen. Okay, I'm delighted, as a matter of fact, very much so, to introduce Fred Krupp, the president of the Environmental Defense Fund. Fred has been the leader of EDF for 29 years, and in that time it has grown from a small nonprofit to a worldwide leader in the environmental movement. Fred is a pioneer in harnessing market forces for environmental ends. He began forging environmental partnerships with corporate America long before it was fashionable to do so. EDF has advised FedEx, Walmart, Citigroup, DuPont, and other market leaders without accepting a penny from them in return. EDF's support comes from its hundreds of thousands of members. In the 1980s, his organization championed the cap and trade system for sulfur dioxide that, passed by Congress as part of the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990, successfully reduced the pollution that causes acid rain. When the first President Bush signed the amendments into law, he thanked Fred for bringing creativity to the table to end what could have been a hopeless stalemate. At that time, he also began devoting considerable time, attention, and resources to the issue of global climate change. More recently, he was among those who led the charge for comprehensive climate legislation in Congress, an effort that so far has come up short. But Fred and EDF never stopped looking for ways to reduce emissions, playing key roles in California's cap on carbon, in China's seven new pilot cap and trade programs, in an innovative new program devoted to accelerating the transition to renewable energy sources in the US, and in the debate over the climate role of natural gas, which he'll be talking about this afternoon. In 2011, Fred served on the Secretary of Energy's Advisory Board for Natural Gas, established at the President's request to chart a safe path forward on shale gas. EDF is currently spearheading groundbreaking studies on methane emissions in partnership with universities, scientists, research facilities, and oil and gas companies. He is the co-author with Miriam Horn of the New York Times bestseller, Earth, the Sequel, the Race to Reinvent Energy and Stop Global Warming. Educated at Yale and at the University of Michigan Law School, Fred lives with his family in Connecticut, where he's an avid rower who likes to rise at dawn to row on the Norwalk River. I'm also delighted to tell you that Fred has been and is a member of the Atkinson Center's External Advisory Board. So without further delay, Ladies and gentlemen, Fred Krupp.
Thanks, Frank. When did it hit you? The realization that we're altering the composition of the atmosphere, spewing carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas pollution in a way that threatens life on Earth. For me, I remember the exact moment. It was a fall day 40 years ago in a lecture given by George Woodwell, then of Stony Brook National Labs. He showed this curve of ambient levels of CO2 above the Mauna Loa volcano, which had been going up for decades. Now, 40 years later, that curve is still going up. And what was then, when I first heard about it, a theoretical danger, is the reality that we're living with. The evidence for this is all around us. In the prolonged drought in the Midwest, in the worst wildfires anyone's seen in the West, in extreme weather, like Hurricane Sandy, storms that are gaining more energy because of the warmth of our oceans and the height of our oceans, we are altering the balance of nature in ways that are truly dangerous. The time to fundamentally change course is long overdue. So, with all that's at stake, I want to spend a few minutes today talking with you about solutions in a very specific and practical way by focusing on three issues related to natural gas. First, I want to talk about local environmental questions, how to protect the communities that live around these natural gas developments. Second, I want to talk about global imperatives, the need to reduce the rate at which methane, a powerful greenhouse gas, is leaking into the atmosphere from our wells and pipelines. And third and finally, I want to talk about whether replacing coal with natural gas can be good for our environment in the short term while we advance the policies and regulations that accelerate the transition to low-carbon energy sources. Now, let me say at the outset that while my subject today is natural gas, I don't want anyone here today to walk away thinking that I think natural gas is the solution for the United States for climate change. If it's done right, natural gas can play a role in slowing climate change and transitioning to a truly clean energy economy, but on its own right, it cannot get us to where we need to go. Nothing I know can substitute for zero carbon sources like conservation, energy efficiency, wind, and solar. Just last year, all renewable energy sources installed contributed more than half of the new electric generating capacity in the United States, and in sum, they're now contributing 12% of our electric generating capacity in the United States. We simply must and we can make this percentage grow. So first then, what about the local impacts of natural gas? This is a matter of a lot of national debate, and a lot of it has been centered right here at Cornell. I want to recognize two professors, Tony Ingrafia and Bob Howarth, who's with us this afternoon, who played a key role in bringing the methane issue to the attention of the public. Any discussion of natural gas, however, must begin with its impact on the people who live in the local communities that surround the drilling. The fact is, people are living with poorly regulated natural gas developments, and many have seen unacceptable impacts to their air, to their water, and to their landscapes. When I was serving on the Secretary of Energy's Advisory Board for Natural Gas, a woman in Washington, Pennsylvania, told our panel, that because of the noxious fumes from a well near her farm, she and her son had been forced to move out of the family house. He was living down the road with neighbors so he could catch the school bus. She was temporarily living out of her car. So at EDF, we've been fighting to protect the air and the groundwater. We've fought for the right of people, of neighbors, of all Americans, to know exactly what chemicals are being pumped down the well shafts and what's coming back up. And more than 20 states now require some disclosure, including Texas, Colorado, Wyoming, and Pennsylvania. But we've got a lot more to do. 2 years ago, the advisory board I served on called for regulations to protect the groundwater, the surface water, air quality, and to minimize the impacts of oil and gas development on the landscape. Since then, some companies have taken action to clean up their drilling practices. Some have even come out for sensible regulation because that they know, they're aware of the fact that there are thousands of companies drilling and just a few cutting corners can put the whole industry's license to operate at risk. Regulation and enforcement are the only ways to hold everyone accountable. And we've won some important battles over the last few years. Texas just recently overhauled its outdated well construction requirements, requiring an array of leading practices to ensure wells are safely constructed and operated. The changes include several dozen ideas that were contained in a model regulatory framework that was co-authored by the Environmental Defense Fund and Southwestern Energy. These new regulations in Texas were lauded by the Lone Star chapter of the Sierra Club. In Wyoming, we partnered with local environmental groups to have new measures that have reduced air pollution from these drilling wells. We're proud of that progress, but I have to say that I cannot point to even one state that protects public health and the environment from oil and gas drilling in ways that I consider adequate. Much more work needs to be done. And it's disappointing that some companies that publicly claim to support tough regulations are either missing in action or downright opposed to improvements when they're actually put on the table. The bottom line is we must protect individuals and families who are being harmed by these developments. No one should have to trade their right to clean air and clean water for the sake of cheap energy. At EDF, we've defended the right of local communities to exercise their traditional zoning authorities over this intensive industrial activity. In Pennsylvania, we joined with local governments and other environmental groups to fight a state law that would have stripped local communities from using these rights. And so far, in the courts, we have won. Now, we know there are also environmentally sensitive places where natural gas development simply should not take place. States must use their powers to make sure that these areas are protected. At the same time, we recognize that many places are embracing gas development, and we need to fight to protect the people who live and work there, too. So whatever your position is on natural gas, the reality is that the technology and market forces are driving a radical expansion in its use. Between 2007 and 2011, the increase in natural gas and shale gas development was 44% per year. Overall, from 2007 to 2011, total production of natural gas in the United States rose from by over 4 trillion cubic feet to 28 trillion cubic feet is what we're producing in the United States now. And because of that, annual coal use is down in our country by more than 115 million tons. The genie, in other words, is out of the bottle. Now, I realize that talking about natural gas development and the regulation of it makes some people uncomfortable. They see the legitimate negative side of these processes. They legitimately see the negative side of these processes and view a detour into natural gas as delaying our transition to renewable energy. I share that concern, but I disagree with the notion that we can somehow stop natural gas development everywhere. To me, it's a little like sex education. Some people are afraid that teaching teenagers about contraception is going to encourage them to have sex. I'm of the view that it's going to happen anyway, so we better make sure we let them know how to do it safely. And I don't think an abstinence-only policy is going to work with natural gas either. I don't think it's realistic. Or consider this reality. 2/3 of the use of natural gas in the United States is not for power plants. It's used to heat homes and businesses and to produce fertilizer and chemical feedstocks. So even if we were to close down every natural gas power plant, we'd still be using well over 16 trillion cubic feet of natural gas a year. All of which means, even as we advance policies to speed the adoption of clean, zero-carbon energy, we have an absolute obligation to make sure natural gas is produced in as clean and as climate-safe manner as possible. Now, as you probably know, methane, which is the main component of natural gas, is far more damaging to our climate in the short run than carbon dioxide. In fact, in its most recent assessment report, the IPCC increased its estimate of the total climate impact of methane, saying that when it's released into the atmosphere unburned, it's 34 times more powerful than CO2 as a heat-trapping gas over 100 years. But over the next 20 years, it's 86 times more powerful ounce per ounce than CO2. What that means is even small leaks of methane are extremely damaging. So what needs to be done? Our first urgent task is to find out how much is leaking and where it's coming from so we can stop it. That's why EDF joined with the University of Texas and over 90 academics, research institutions, and companies to undertake 16 research studies of methane emissions over the entire supply chain. You may have heard that the first of these studies was released in September. It focused on production, measuring emissions that occur in that first phase of extraction of methane, of natural gas, using hydraulic fracturing. This study is important because it was the first with new empirical data on these new production methods. Now, I realize that some don't like the idea of environmentalists working with industry on these problems, but here it was very useful to have industry giving us access to their facilities, which was critical to taking the measurements. All the partners agreed in a binding contract that the academic scientists would carry out their study with no interference from the companies or from advocates, and that the results would all be peer-reviewed. The scientists drew up the criteria for what sites would be studied, and the companies made all of their sites available. There was no cherry-picking. Now, this was just the first of 16 studies. It used a bottoms-up method, going on the ground and measuring methane emissions. Other of our upcoming studies are using top-down or flyover techniques, where we literally take measurements from airplanes and use other innovative approaches. And we're going to be moving outside the production fields across the entire chain of natural gas, processing plants, pipelines, storage facilities, and the distribution pipes that bring the gas to individual consumers. But the results of just this first study have proved very valuable. Let me just say a word about what it showed and what it doesn't say. First and foremost, it suggests that the EPA regulations on green completions work extremely well. These completions capture methane during that final phase of the hydraulic fracturing process. I'm sure this wasn't welcome news to many of the less responsible companies in industry that fought against these regulations, or to those who reflexively oppose EPA regulations. The study showed that properly designed wells release less than 0.5% of their gas, which is in the range we need to make sure that there's a climate benefit compared to burning coal when it's used to generate electricity. But what the study does not say, even though the American Petroleum Institute claimed it did, and some politicians have claimed, is that the EPA regulations were unnecessary or that natural gas is good for the environment. In fact, we believe it clearly demonstrates that the regulations are necessary, that they have been effective, and that their full implementation, which won't happen until January 2015, is absolutely essential. Moreover, the study results, in my view, suggest we need to extend the reach of these regulations. Right now, they only apply to natural gas wells, but there are plenty of other oil wells that produce natural gas that these regulations have not yet been covered by the Obama administration's decisions. The study also found that emissions from some of the production activities are much higher than EPA estimated. Equipment is leaking. Leaks from equipment the industry calls fugitive methane. And we need new rules to cover these emissions. We have the technology to prevent these leaks. When this product is captured, it can be used and sold. So what we need to do is capture these fugitives and put them to work. The first study, by the way, does not cover other parts of the methane, of the natural gas supply chain. And we will learn more from the airplane monitors that have been deployed as to where other leaks in the system are. But we know even from the first study that there are serious leaks. So anyone who tells you that methane leakage from the natural gas industry is not a problem is either being disingenuous or is just uninformed. And there's another misuse of these studies that I'd like to address. While data collection is extremely important, it should never be used to delay action. We don't need to wait to implement those recommendations from the Secretary of Energy's advisory panel that I served on. 2 years ago, we issued those recommendations. The time to implement them is overdue. We should take those steps immediately. So finally, having described the serious questions around the issues of natural gas, I want to talk for a few minutes about its promise as well. If natural gas is extracted and used properly, it produces about 0.5 the amount of greenhouse gases emissions of coal, and is cleaner in other ways too. It's begun to replace coal in many areas. Companies who were planning to build coal plants in the past are now ramping up existing underutilized natural gas plants instead. If I had told you 10 years ago that I had a plan that would compel utilities like the Southern Company or AEP to drop plans to build coal-fired plants and replace them with facilities that produce 0.5 as much carbon dioxide, you'd ask me how much I was smoking. In fact, 5 years ago, EDF engaged in an epic battle to stop the Texas utility TXU from building 8 new coal plants. At the start, it was an uphill fight, and many thought we'd certainly lose. But with activism from the streets to the boardroom, we prevailed. What's really amazing is that in 5 years, how much the world has shifted. No utility in America would now dream of proposing 8 new coal-fired power plants. I know there are those who believe that natural gas is an irresponsible diversion from the path to renewable energy. But for now, natural gas is part of our current energy mix, and there is major climate damage at stake if we don't get these methane emissions under control. In addition to replacing coal, natural gas can help support the deployment of more wind and solar. Modern natural gas turbines fire up quickly, so when clouds pass overhead or when the wind dies down, they interfere with the generation of electricity, and natural gas can help there allow renewables to penetrate deeper. So whether you believe that renewables will penetrate deeply and will move to zero carbon energy in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, I think everyone acknowledges it won't happen overnight, which means we have a moral obligation to be clear-eyed and realistic about how we handle the transition. Congress is not likely to repeat the big funding for renewables that happened at the beginning of the Obama administration. And Congress has shown no willingness to enact a market signal like a carbon tax or a cap and trade in the near future. We have to continue to fight to internalize those externalities, put caps and limits on carbon, put a price on carbon. But in the meantime, we need to do everything we can to reduce emissions today, and that includes making natural gas development as climate safe as possible. Because as we speak, new gas wells are being drilled, methane is being leaked, and pollution is accumulating in our atmosphere. At EDF, we're working for that clean energy future. Our fastest growing program is focused on smart power, replacing a century-old utility grid, a system that's wasteful, expensive, and polluting. Perhaps $2 trillion will be invested in modernizing the grid over the next 20 years, and that's an opening, a window of opportunity for us to maximize the use of clean energy and to help guide a technological revolution similar to what happened in the telecommunications industry. We're beginning to see it with a range of innovations that are forging a new, modern, and intelligent energy system, one that has the potential to be as interactive as an iPad, one that's open to clean technologies, renewables, efficiencies, consumer choice, distributed energy. Make no mistake, our future lies with solar, with wind, with energy efficiency, and with other forms of low-carbon energy sources. I don't want to see more natural gas infrastructure built out. I want to see truly clean energy infrastructure. But let me also say one thing about the economics and politics of natural gas. As environmentalists, our priority is always human health and the natural world. But we can't ignore the fact that the expansion of natural gas is perhaps the most positive development for American manufacturing since World War II. We will insist on strong environmental standards to protect our environment. But we can't forget the union members and other workers who are seeing jobs return to our cities and our factories. Many people are struggling nowadays to get by, desperate for good jobs. We have proclaimed our urgency to replace dirty coal and reduce emissions. So if properly regulated natural gas can help do both, how do we explain our rigid opposition? With so much economic insecurity around us, we cannot just be the community of no. Having said that, let me close by being clear about this. I know the activists who oppose fracking are acting in good faith, and they're making an incredibly valuable contribution to the debate. They've raised the public consciousness about the negative sides of this technology, defending communities, protecting clean water, and standing up to powerful and well-funded corporations. It's in all of our interest that they keep up the pressure for transparency and local control and strict environmental standards. And as they do that, we will keep up the fight for the most responsible approach to natural gas. My hope is that together, each fighting in our own way, we can move this country toward healthier communities and a safer climate for our children. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Fred. So we're going to have a question and answer period. We already have a couple of questions that come in. And then we'll take questions from the audience. I think what we decided to do is to try, we'll take two or three questions that Fred will write down and then respond to them collectively. And so I think we'll start. Do you want to start with this first one here while we're getting set up? Okay.
So the first question is, won't expenditure to build our natural gas infrastructure lock the United States into long-term dependency on natural gas and a diversion from renewables? Well, I wish that EDF and the environmental community as a whole were powerful enough to determine what expenditures and infrastructure were happening. The point is that the country is moving to build more natural gas infrastructure, more natural gas pipelines, rebuild distribution systems. So we have to advocate to speed up renewable energy, absolutely. But as natural gas infrastructure is built, we have to make sure it's as clean and as safe as possible.
So we have two microphones, one on each side. If you put up your hand if you want to ask a question. Up here, Paul.
Good afternoon. I have a public health question, which might not be a public health question, this debate that you may have heard before. I'm hoping you have. But if not, then maybe there are others in the audience that can help address it. It goes to the first point you talked about, local communities, and it's regarding the amount of radon in this gas and the fact that because it doesn't come from far away, the radioactivity in that radon may not have enough chance to decay before it's actually in someone's household. And isn't that is that a real risk factor, and should we be worrying about that in this debate?
We have a graduate student in the first row who's an expert on radionuclides. I am not, but...
Before we do that, we might see what a second question is, and then we'll try to address two. Do we have a second question over here? Yes.
I was wondering... I was wondering if EDF had looked into the ability for the natural gas infrastructure to carry renewables. We've got a lot of ability for biomass and garbage to be converted into methane and used in the same infrastructure, as well as using hydrogen converted from excess electricity, also be blended into that same infrastructure as well. I was wondering if EDF had been looking into those possibilities at all.
We got two. Do you want to try those two?
Sure. I'm serious. If you have an answer to the radon question, feel free. Radionuclides, yeah.
Radionuclides that are actually present in mineralized
forms. Yeah. Just as a disclaimer, I'm a first-year doctoral student, so if my research advisor wants to jump in and correct me. I have not specifically looked at the question of radon, but there are radioactive minerals, and we are able to, the research that I'm working on right now within the Earth and Atmospheric Sciences Department in the Earth and Energy Systems IGERT. What we're trying to do right now is correlate organic content across the Marcellus Shale with uranium content. And we're hoping to develop a subsurface mapping system so that we can actually predict hotspots where we would see radioactive material in the flowback waters and put in place regulations, which we would develop with the New York State Water Resources Institute on campus. So we are looking at these hotspot areas, and we recognize that it is a problem that some of these radioactive elements are making their ways to municipal wastewater treatment plants in Pennsylvania. And so now that we're learning from those case studies, we do hope to in the future put in place better regulations so we wouldn't have that issue. Of course, that's separate from the radon issue, which I would defer to the Water Resource Institute for more information on that, since there's a difference between the gaseous components and the liquid components.
You're saying radon is carried in the natural gas? Is that the...
That's my understanding, but again, I'm a chemist, but I'm not a geochemist, so...
I haven't seen data. I will check with our team to see if they have seen data.
But the most recent data I could find was from 1980, so it would be great to see if there's more data out there.
Well, radon is a serious issue. I'd love to see the data, and I'll check with our team, see if they have. On the infrastructure question, I think the idea of using surplus electricity to make hydrogen has, promise. In Texas, there's parts of the year where they're now grounding wind power that's otherwise being produced at night. Why not use it to create hydrogen? I don't know that EDF is analyzing the costs and benefits of that, but we are very concerned about the grounding of wind power in Texas and figuring out how to match the demand with the supply. In other words, how we can move a lot of uses of electricity at nighttime. Probably your freezer and your refrigerator doesn't really need to defrost at 2 p.m. It can defrost at 2 a.m. Electric car batteries can be charged at night, and on and on.
Well, I was also asking about waste energy, waste to methane, biomass to methane. There's a lot of, here in New York, we've got vast resources not being utilized that could be blended into the exact same infrastructure, using the same power plants, using the same cars.
Yeah. It's definitely a good thing, which we have been supported to harvest the methane from landfills and use it. We've been supporting programs like in California where from animal waste they're producing methane and using it. So you're absolutely right. And in a lot of cases, you not only get to use it and displace other energy sources, but methane would otherwise just be vented into the atmosphere from the landfill. So we have been very active with the EPA to put regulations in place on landfills to control what they're emitting into the atmosphere.
Good. While we're waiting for a few more questions to come in from the online people, we've got one question back here, and we've got a couple up front. We've got one up here.
Thank you, Fred. I appreciate your talk. Just a brief statement on the radon. The U.S. Geological Survey is looking at radon as an issue, and their preliminary work shows that there's about 10,000-fold more radon in dry gas from the Marcellus than is true of most natural gas, simply because the gas isn't decaying over geological time as it moves to a formation, as would be true of a conventional gas. When the gas is processed, that radon is taken out, I am told. So the worry is with dry gas that goes directly to the pipe and is not processed. With wet gas, it's processed, and the radon ends up with the propane stream. So those of you with propane in your home should be worried about that. But my question is on the jobs. You say that we should be allowing or even encouraging natural gas because of the jobs and because of the manufacturing, and I hear you. I'm one of the authors of the 2030 plan that Mark Jacobson wrote, saying we should make the state free of fossil fuels as quickly as possible. And I gave a talk on that in New York City back in May, I believe it was, and to a union group. I was surprised because I thought, the boiler makers were there, the coal plant operators were there. I expected to be attacked from them. I wasn't. These guys who are in their 50s and 60s our age said, they see the end of their careers, but they could see in the Jacobson plan new jobs for their people. They could see that the hydrogen economy would have workers in it. And on average for the United States, we get about 3 times more jobs out of renewable energy than out of the fossil fuel energy. I'm not sure about gas per se versus that, but are you and others at EDF looking truly in a comparative way at the jobs from renewables as opposed to gas?
Before you get to that one, there's a question down here. Let's try to keep it short, please. We can ask as many questions as possible.
Thank you. I've been struggling to understand the EDF position, especially when it comes to sort of a vague acknowledgement that people are suffering because of the extraction of gas by unconventional methods. And I think I got the answer in your talk, because you compared a parent's worry about a child having sex too early to fracking. And it's inevitable anyway. Natural gas is inevitable. And it came to me that the whole comparison is wrong, because sex is a loving thing that two people do because they care about each other. And it's something that parents should hope their children will have a lifetime of loving sex. But fracking is like rape. It's nothing like a loving act. And I think maybe that's the problem. So I ask you if EDF could think about looking at people, individuals, in the communities where they're being harmed. There's a list of the harmed by Jenny Lissack that has thousands of instances of humans who are hurt by this. If you could look at that and come to the communities in Pennsylvania where people, their properties, their health, their homes are being damaged, maybe you'd have a little bit of a different look. So I invite you to come with us on a tour. We'd be happy to host you.
So, thank you. For Professor Howard's question, I would say this. I don't think I did say we should encourage natural gas because of the jobs. I think what I said is that we should be aware of the fact that natural gas has been an economic benefit to the United States and has created jobs. And not to acknowledge that, not to acknowledge that it has lowered electricity prices, not as much as perhaps should have, but it has lowered electricity prices, not to acknowledge the benefits to the U.S. economy and to jobs and individual workers, I think is to ignore an important reality when our economy has in hard times. But I absolutely agree with the bigger point you're making, that there's a lot of jobs to be had in renewables. And we've put up a database documenting jobs by congressional district that are created by wind turbines and solar power and energy efficiency and insulation. And absolutely, we should be doing more of that and making that connection crystal clear as we advocate for renewables. I agree with that. We have done it. We should all be doing it more. I've been to Pennsylvania. I look forward to going again. But I've spent time with hundreds of people who have been impacted, and some who live around these facilities and haven't been impacted because they've been done in a responsible way. But for those who are living around the facilities that are being impacted, you know, that is what motivates us to try to get the regulations in place so that they aren't continually impacted by groundwater that's infected or by air pollution. And, there are hundreds of thousands of wells around this country, millions of wells, and I think we can't just pretend that the drilling is going to stop. We have to make sure people are protected to not engage in having stronger regulations means that we're leaving those people defenseless. And that's not something the Environmental Defense Fund is going to do. We're going to be there. But for those communities that want to say there should be no fracking, we're going to support their right to have zoning, to have the rules they want. And we're going to support states' rights to make their own decisions, too. But there are some places that are going to go forward. That's the reality.
So maybe I'll read this one that came in online. EDF has close ties to oil and gas industry and has major funders with interests in fracking. How does EDF claim to objectivity on this issue? Don't you have a conflict of interest?
It's a good question. We have, I suppose we have ties to the oil and gas industry because we've been working with many companies to measure their emissions. And those companies have funded the universities that are doing the studies, as we have also contributed funds. But we have not taken monies from the oil and gas industry. As to our supporters, I'm sure out of our hundreds of thousands of supporters, there are many who have made money on oil and gas stocks. And we accept their support. I know some people feel like we should screen our supporters and not accept money from those who have made money in this industry or that. We feel as though if people involved in the industry or have profited from the industry personally want to help contribute to our efforts, we're grateful for that.
More questions? We have any over here on this side? Let's see, and this is one in the back, back here.
Thanks. I'm just curious, why doesn't EDF work to eliminate the exemptions in the oil and gas industry, one, to requirements to comply with the clean provisions of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act? Wouldn't that do the most to protect people's health and public health and safety if the oil and gas industry had to comply?
Boy, you have more confidence in Washington than I do. Have you been watching the last few weeks? EPA now has the authority to regulate air emissions from oil and gas operations, and we are urging them to do that. We are going to work hard to get them to do that. We're going to cooperate with them every way we can, and I think many other environmental groups are going to be with us. I can't tell you right now to what extent EPA is going to regulate what they already have authority to. I agree with you that the loopholes and the exemptions ought not be, but we need to put our effort where we can make the most difference. Right now, getting this Congress to repeal those loopholes, I don't know anyone who can suggest a viable strategy. So I could spend $1,000 or $1 million or $10 million, and I'd be wasting your money if you're an EDF supporter. In the states, we've been able to begin, we're not done, but we've begun to see a series of states improving their regulations. So that's where we're putting our energy, because we're getting results. So yeah, I guess it might be nice to say that I've got 10 people working, to get Congress to fix those loopholes. It might be nice to say, but it wouldn't be a responsible use of money.
Other questions? Let's see.
So I actually have two quick questions, and then the woman next to me has one as well, so I'll pass it to her. One is, you said that the estimate from the most recent report was that it was 0.5% methane was released as compared to production, but over what time frame is that? Because most unconventional wells are no older than about 10 years old. So just wondering, in the 30, 40, 50-year time frame, if that number is still true. And then the second question also is about natural gas exports. There's been a lot of discussion about increasing exports or exporting at all from the U.S. And obviously that would have a big impact on the rate of production and also on, bringing natural gas prices up to closer to world levels, which would affect manufacturing and other issues. So just wondering if EDF has a position on that.
That was actually my question. It's okay. Would you continue to support natural gas development in the face of large-scale pipelines to coastal facilities which export it overseas, which seems to be what fossil fuel companies are attempting to do? Their motivation is to maximize their profit, and right now gas is cheap, so that's what I understand they're trying to do, and it will bring bring the price of natural gas to Americans up to a global level. It will no longer be cheap. It will no longer help our industries. So we'll have a fracked land and increased fracking to support to maximize the profits of companies who are selling it overseas, and we're not willing to see that. Would you continue to support gas drilling in that scenario?
Yeah. Well, I think talking is all about communicating, and I think I've failed to communicate. We are not supporting natural gas or drilling. We are supporting the idea of protecting people, protecting the environment, protecting the water, protecting the air. So we're not out there campaigning for more wells or more drilling or more exports. On the export question, we haven't taken a position, but I am concerned, and I'm, you know, looking for analysis of the numbers of when you liquefy natural gas, what that does to the greenhouse gas footprint, but undoubtedly it makes natural gas a worse fuel because it takes a lot of energy to liquefy it. And so it makes it a worse fuel for the climate. But I want to see the analysis of that. On the question of 0.5% or 1%, that's a number just in the production stage. So we have a lot more work before we know the total amount of methane leaking. But to the extent your question is asking, is that number for the entire life of the well? Yes, it's my understanding that it is. But if you send me an email, I will check with our scientists and verify that. My email is pretty simple for anybody that wants. It's just fred@edf.org. But don't misunderstand me. That half of 1% is for those wells studied here, and it's just part of the chain. We will find other leaks and other methane releases as we investigate the whole chain, for sure.
Back here.
Has consideration been given to bonding and insurance of all the actors and all the entities involved in drilling, which is maybe might be more effective having bonding and insurance agencies looking over it than trying to make specific regulations about how you do things, which can be lead to loopholes as opposed to measuring, you know, having looking at the impact and whether somebody will actually bond and insure you to do it.
Any more questions? Way up the top.
Hi, my question is a little more localized. I'm asking a question about New York State. So currently we're in our sixth year of a moratorium on fracking in New York State. And you said that the EPA regulation on green completion worked well on trapping some of the harmful methane, which is like a huge issue with like the people that are against it. So my question is the EDF working with anyone in New York State to like overcome our barriers with fracking and the issues with fracking here?
Sure. So on the bonding question, I would say you get at a very important point. Ultimately, the issue isn't about exactly what a regulation says. It's about behavior in the field. And what we really want is compliance. We want people doing all the right things. And so, yes, we have considered and in some cases, looked very specifically at bonding requirements and a variety of other schemes and suggestions where the operators certify that things are done in a certain way, done right. In the Clean Air Act, we have provisions that the operators of power plants need to certify that their report on emissions are accurate. And if it turns out they were falsifying that certification, they can be convicted of a felony and go to jail. So we are looking at the whole gamut of how do you get compliance, because to have a good scheme on paper and not having it enforced, not having people actually doing things differently doesn't help. The New York State, we have been asked from over the last few years by the different state agencies for what we know about natural gas, what other states have models. As I said in my talk, we can't point to one state that does everything right, but we can point to the states that do air pollution best or the states that do the well regulations the best. And we can also point out areas where it could be done even better. And we have shared that information with people not only in New York State, but regulators all over the country. We're accessible.
I'll read this one.
Sure.
This one's from California. Oil for Monterey Shale is not cleaner than coal and causes real damage to health and environment. Do you support fracking ban in California?
Yeah. Oil from Monterey Shale is completely different than shale gas. It's a whole different thing. And, you know, we have not supported a fracking ban in California, nor have we opposed a fracking ban in California. But we're following very carefully the new rules that are being put in place in California on fracking. And definitely looking at the greenhouse gas impacts of different fossil fuels that come out of the ground.
Okay, there's two questions way in the back.
I would like to come back to your 0.5%. It sounds pretty small, but it's more than I'm getting on my savings account. And if the water in my house was leaking at the rate of 0.5%, I would have a lot of mildew. So I claim that's a very high amount. So why is it existing? Well, obviously it's economics. It would cost the companies more to fix that 0.5% than they want to spend. So do you think there's any chance of regulations which represent an expense to the company until they reduce it to a lower level? So I would say fines of some sort. Do you think it would work? Do you think there would be any way to get such regulations through? Or is this just pie in the sky? You're never going to do it.
I think there was a second question right beside you.
Thank you. I want to come back to the question of the potential for conflicts of interest, giving 90% funding for the study or interest within EDF itself. I understand, and I can wrap my head around the idea that some of your supporters are going to have investments in natural gas. I understand that. Everyone would. However, I think it's a little deeper than that. For instance, Julian Robertson gave $10.5 million to EDF in 2011 and has significant investments and an advisory role on a $500 million natural gas infrastructure project. Stanley Buckenmiller has major funder for EDF, numerous investments in oil and gas industry. A number of your board members have investments and interests in natural gas companies, including the granddaughter of the father of fracking, George Mitchell. How is it that, as EDF, you can represent a clean scientific basis or the environmental movement's interest on natural gas when you have such stark monetary interests through your board and through your top investors in natural gas? Thank you.
There's no question that, you know, we've got supporters that have made money on natural gas. We also have supporters that have made fortunes on solar energy and wind power. Money is made in our economy from a whole lot of activities, including fossil fuel. You know, when money comes to us from individuals who want to support us, we accept that, and we make sure in terms of our studies that there's an independent science advisory committee, that the studies are peer-reviewed, that the science is good science. In our positions, we're responsible to our membership, to our board of directors, which includes almost 40 people. We've got to be accountable for the fact that our positions are the best ones for the environment and for the climate. And ultimately, you know, I think they are. So be happy to talk to you about, you know, the merits of our positions. But I think we've been very, very rigorous about who we accept money from, in that we're unusual in the environmental community in not accepting money from companies that have a direct financial position and an interest in these issues.
That was a previous question.
The previous question was on the 0.5%. I actually agree with you that 0.5% is a lot. That's what we found so far. But we've also found opportunities to reduce that 0.5% to a lower number. So that 0.5% is composed of leaks from equipment as well as valves. And it turns out that through a systematic use of leak detection and repair methodologies, you can reduce these leaks by 80%. So there's a lot of room to cost effectively drive down the leak rate in the production fields from 0.5% to something lower. The lower it gets, the more we're protecting the climate. So we're not sitting back satisfied that 0.5% is not much. And to me, it sounds like a lot when I know the break-even rate versus coal, according to the new IPCC numbers, is about 2.7%. So 0.5% is a significant amount.
One question right here. This microphone is coming.
Regarding eventually moving toward a very large part of our energy coming from renewables, is New York State's ban on fracking now doing more good than harm or harm than good?
That's one. Do we have any more over here? I'm just looking to come around over here, up here. Trying to look for things in the back. I haven't seen many questions from the back.
Another foreign trade question. I've been reading in a variety of places that one of the consequences of the low price of gas and therefore the shift into gas out of coal has been increased exports of coal to progress, places like Germany, which actually have fairly progressive policies around renewable. I'm wondering if you could comment on if you're aware of the extent of that, whether that's an important issue or a small issue, and kind of like maybe more generally, if you have any thoughts about sort of unintended consequences of things in a system that that is a pretty complex system that we're trying to work with.
Yeah. So on the New York State ban, whether it's doing more harm than good or more good than harm, I would say that, the governor has said that he's waiting till the health studies are completed. I think human health is a hugely important thing. And so we'll see, what happens. I respect the position that the governor's taken, that he wants the advice from his Department of Health. And we'll see what's next. On the foreign trade question, we're not going to be safe until countries agree to limit the amount of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases that can be put into the air. And so, yes, I am concerned about the increased coal exports from the United States. Yes, I am concerned about the increased use of coal in Germany and in the United Kingdom, which burned, I think, 50% more coal in 2012 than 2011. Yes, I'm concerned about the electricity that Germany is planning to import and importing from outside of its boundaries from countries that are burning coal. And that's why we need to accelerate in every way we can the drive to get an international agreement to limit the amount of greenhouse gases that countries put in the air, starting with the United States and China, who are the world's two biggest emitters, and then followed by Brazil and Indonesia, who are number four and number three.
Any more questions? Online, you got one chance? It's way in the back.
Hi, Hi, Fred. It's Walter Hang. It seems like 37 years have gone by very quickly since we were little EDF interns baking to death in the library. Congratulations on all your success.
Walter and I share the same birthday, by the way.
Yes, I was going to. Thank you for remembering that, Fred. So you used a key word, which I hate to do this, but you said that the Department of Health was doing a study. And with all respect, I would like to correct you. As you know, the Department of Health Commissioner Nirav R. Shah is conducting a review of the health impact analysis in the revised draft supplemental generic environmental impact statement. And so your colleague on the hydrofracking panel has received more than 1,000 requests to put this Department of Health review, which has no public participation, no public documentation about what they're actually doing, on hold, and to do a comprehensive public health impact study openly, transparently. So number one, I'd like to know whether you have thought about supporting that since Donna Lopardo, the assembly representative from Binghamton, recently wrote to Commissioner Martens to submit that request. And then finally, in closing, I would say New York, as was noted, has never had a single horizontally hydrofracked production well in Marcellus Shale. And that's, I believe, a direct result of what I learned working with Joe Hyland and Bob Harris, combining science with grassroots organizing. So we are the epicenter, and I believe we're the only hope for actually preventing the hazards. As you know, enforcement doesn't work very well. So someone talked about financial surety. That's really strict liability. So we want to trust these companies when they say they've never had problems. But if, heaven forbid, there are problems, that would just get the crap sued out of them so that, you know, victims can be made whole. So those two questions. Department of Health review, will you support putting it on hold, doing a study? And will you help us in New York make sure that we hold the line to try to come up with that state model that you were referring to? Do it here well, and then replicate that nationwide. Thanks, Fred.
Okay. So, trying to remember the first.
First was about the health study, the health review in New York State.
Walter's two questions. Yeah, no. I heard both of Walter's questions. No. I thought there was a second questioner.
No.
Thank you, Walter, for correcting me. Review rather than study. I get that. And on your question on New York State and our position, you know, Mark Brownstein, as you know, is our representative on that commission. I'm not as familiar as he is with that, so I will take that question, you know, back to him. On financial surety, I see the value of, you know, financial surety, as I tried to say in answer to the previous questioner. You know, the idea of companies being liable when they should be is a familiar one and a powerful one and should be deployed in our arsenal of efforts to clean up what's going on.
And with that, I'd like to thank Fred, and we'll close this up. Fred?
Okay.